5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, ignition, liftoff.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brian Clapp, Director of Content for WorkinSports.com, and this is the Work in Sports podcast. People tune into sports as an escape. Their day-to-day lives hold stress, bills to pay, meetings to attend, promotions to fight for, sickness, relationships, all stressful endeavors. Sports, either playing them or watching them, in theory is a release, a chance to tune out the external stressors and enjoy an art form that is not on canvas with oils and acrylics, but on turf with muscles and mind power. My career has embodied this to a T. I thought about working in hard news, but the constant stress of politics and death and fire and traffic and tragedy and peril was just too much for me. Sports was light, a passion play that I could engage my mind into the strategy, but stay loose and separate from the constant constriction of life. But in all honesty, this is a pretty naive viewpoint, because sports isn't separate from society, quite the opposite. Sports is a microcosm for society, mirroring the way it operates and often dealing with large-scale issues before they become large-scale. Call sports a precursor to global events, almost a trial society where issues are played out in real time, then graduated to the society at large. The sports world is complete with society's conflicts, assets, and defects. Our escape world is not bereft of greed, corruption, inequality, or entitlement. Our personal utopia isn't all upside. It's flawed and broken, just like the rest of the world. In sports, we deal with real-life issues like Ray Rice and Kareem Hunt's issues with abuse, Tonya Harding conspiring to assault a competitor, Pete Rose gambling, the list could go on. We deal with people ruined by drugs and alcohol like Roy Tarpley, Josh Gordon, Mickey Mantle, Lance Armstrong. We talk about social justice issues in the context of Colin Kaepernick. But the use of sports as a platform for social justice started decades ago. Why does sports act as a microcosm for our world? Well, I think it's because sports is the ultimate meritocracy. Elite athletes are put into position to thrive based purely on their skills and ability, not their color, not their gender. If they stink, they get cut. If they thrive and achieve and lead, they get signed to massive contracts. If coaches win, they stay. If coaches lose, they go. They know this, so they sign the players that are going to help them win no matter what they look like. When you have a meritocracy, it almost forces diversity because different people in different sports succeed in different ways. There is some balance, but not all is rosy. The workplace in sports is just like the workplace in every other business in the world. There are struggles to enforce diversity and inclusion. Teams have had massive problems with these tenets. Google stories on the Dallas Mavericks and the Atlanta Hawks and your jaw could drop. They are far from the only two. This issue is hot, it's important, and it deserves constant conversation and, more importantly, action. There are leaders in the field of diversity and inclusion as it relates to sports, and none are more impressive than today's guest, Vincent Pearson, Director of Diversity and Inclusion for all of Minor League Baseball. Let's get to this conversation. Here's Vincent Pearson. Hey, Vince, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Brian. How are you?
I'm doing really well, and I'm excited about this conversation because this is one of those subjects we haven't talked a lot about, but we need to. So I'm glad that I've got you on the show, and your role is so important in minor league baseball. But before we get into all the extremely important issues, let's talk a little bit about you. You did your undergrad at Virginia State. You graduated in 2011. Was this the point that you had an intention to work in sports, or was that something that developed over your college experience?
No, I think that I always knew I wanted to work in sports. I'll tell you, when I started in college, you couldn't have convinced me that I wasn't going to play sports. So I was that person for a little while, chasing the game for, you know, a few years longer than I should have. But at the moment that I realized that that's not how I was going to make a living, I immediately knew I wanted to stay within sport, close to the game, and you know, for a lot of different reasons that have definitely evolved over time. At first, I was thinking, well, if I can't play, I got to coach. And my sport of choice was basketball. But eventually, you know, as I graduated from Virginia State and landed my first position in sport, I realized My passion for this industry goes beyond what happens on the field. I actually love that so many lives are touched by sport, including my own. And now that presents a great opportunity to, one, bring people together, and two, really create some life-changing experiences. And so now, you know, I think it worked out perfectly with the position I landed in, but I learned really early on in my career that that was the power of sport that attracted me to this industry.
Yeah, I bet. And you said the career you landed in, I want to get into that later about how you got to this path, but let's talk a little bit about your master's. You went back and got your master's from Central Florida. Why was that an important step for you? And how much did getting that extra layer of education help kind of open doors in your career and kind of frame where you wanted to go?
So for me, going back to the University of Central Florida, well, going back to school at the University of Central Florida was important because it was a leap of faith for me. I'm from Roanoke, Virginia. I went to school at Virginia State. My first 22, 23 years of my life, I was in Virginia in a very comfortable space.
Okay.
This was me picking up my life. Well, it was first I quit my full-time job at the Colonial Athletic Association at the time, which is the first time my mom, to my face, called me stupid. and so
kind of like your mom,
full-time job to go get back in line and, you know, want to fight for a job in sports. But I was really convicted at the time that I wanted something that really appealed to a lot more of my senses in terms of just compassion. And I saw something in the program at the University of Central Florida, specifically the chair, Dr. Richard Lapchick, and his background and really just pioneering using sports for positive change in society. I thought, if at 23 I can go sit next to a human being like this who has a lifetime dedicated to flipping sports into positive social change, I don't think that's something I'll regret. I think I'll be better for it. And oh, by the way, I'll get a master in business administration. If all else fails, I'll get a job outside of sports and start making real money early.
Yeah.
So, you know, and I have to, I hope you don't mind, our program just recently suffered a really severe loss. One of our professors, Mike Redlick, actually passed away this past weekend. I just, thinking about UCF, it's a very touching moment right now. I was his first graduate assistant. So I just, you know, want to take a moment to send love to the DeVos family, send love to the Redlick family first and foremost, and just, you know, just give him his love. I definitely wouldn't be where I am if it weren't for him and the investment he made in my career, and the friendship he gave, and definitely just trying time for the family and for his extended family in DeVos. Bit of a tangent there, but
it's okay.
Totally on my mind as I talk about my UCF experience.
Well, no, that's important. And I think that having a mentor that's helped to guide and frame who you are, and then being able to respect that in a time of pain that you're dealing with right now, of course, is a good platform for that.
I appreciate that.
Before we get back into the deeper subjects, you said that your mom, that was the first time she'd called you stupid. Has there been any experiences like that since? has she called you stupid since then?
Not to my face. So I don't doubt that it's happened, but she's been kind enough to vent that frustration and then come with a more constructive criticism when she brings it to me.
Okay, so while you're getting your master's, you mentioned you were a graduate assistant in the Institute for Diversity and Ethics, and you talked about your mentors and how they've been pillars in this side of the sports industry for decades, and yet it seems like this is something a lot of us are just learning about now, right? We're just starting to talk about the importance of diversity and inclusion, and I'm seeing more jobs posted that involve, like yours, that are diversity and inclusion. Get into the details of this program, like what you were able to do as a graduate assistant and how that helped kind of frame your perspective. What was that experience like for you?
So that was really a great, and it was kind of my first time realizing that, okay, there is actually of space for this. I always thought that anything I did that was directly geared toward, you know, building or engaging minority communities based on that premise alone would be a side project or something I would have to create on my extra hours, either at work or personally. But the experience at UCF with the Institute for Diversity, Ethics in Sport actually allowed me to realize, okay, this is something that organizations care about. This is a skill set that organizations need. So that experience allowed me to actually touch every major professional sport. The way that it worked is our graduate assistants, we would divvy up and split up the leagues and go through the data that they provided for us. And then obviously we would support one another throughout that process. So we got to look at the NBA, MLS, NCAA football, coaches. We even looked at sport media representatives and went through and created essentially a demographic profile that would, and then there was a process Dr. Lapchick had created that would give them a grade. And each year it'd be posted on ESPN. So it was cool because we got to see our work then be posted on ESPN. It's like, wow, we would get credits for the assistance we provided. That part of it was cool. But then also to know that these leagues respond to that
right,
because of the platform that is being put on. And then you start to see the power and then you start to see the unique positioning for this type of work. And it's like, okay, there's a field for this. This is something that could actually be done. And I think that's when kind of the light bulb went off. And even then, it was too ambiguous to go and target during my graduate school experience.
Right.
But that's when the light bulb went off that, okay, this is more than just a side project. This is a thing.
Yeah, this is a direction. So at the same time, there's a lot going on in the kind of global news conversation too, you could say. There's things happening outside of sports. There's things happening inside of sports. And there's a lot more attention drawn to the subjects of equality and diversity and social justice. Was that also kind of an underlying kind of inspiration to you, is to see what was happening out in the wide landscape of the world and know that there was an impact you could make using that towards sports as well?
Yeah, most definitely. And I can share that when I was going into the DeVos program, it was the summer of 2013, and in the previous year, Trayvon Martin was killed.
Right.
And his trial played out that spring and summer. And I that was a moment for me where I watched that trial probably at unhealthy rates. I followed it as closely as I could, and the final verdict was crushing for me. But kind of looking back now and seeing how the sport community embraced that story, how the sport community really put it on a different platform. And again, that's the power of sport. Once athletes started to tell the story, it became a global story.
That's right. Yep.
And so it is very, it's not lost on me that we are also in a similar space, and I can share with minor league baseball. And I know we've not gotten there yet, but when the Charleston shooting happened in the church in Charleston, and the name escapes me at the moment, our team was able to step in and support the families who were impacted and make a donation, and we were able to match their donation. And it's just like, that may not make front page news for CNN what minor league did, but I know that family will never forget.
Yeah.
So we still have an opportunity to, again, create those memories within our ballparks and in our communities and change lives. And unfortunately, tragedy is something that, it can't be avoided, but we can, it does provide an opportunity to step up and show that we are committed to our communities. But, getting a bit of a tangent, I feel like what happens in society and what happens in sport are almost, to me, directly intertwined, because sport transcends it's the playing field.
Right.
And we get into society. I've had conversations where I'm like, in the entire country, with all that happens, good and bad, there's one organization that everybody's looking at and wondering what they're going to do about the domestic violence issue in our country, and that's the National Football League. No other organization or company or no one in Silicon Valley is being asked those questions, but the National Football League is being held accountable, and I don't think that's unfair. I think that's rightfully so. And I think that's a message on the opportunity and responsibility of sport to transcend our playing field and impact society, because we're uniquely positioned to do so.
It's so true. And so many of us that have worked in sports our entire career, I'll say that I think sometimes we get looked at as, I don't know, sports fans and lug nuts and like not these extremely intelligent people, and that, you know, there are bigger issues than sports and blah, blah, blah. And yet you look at it and say, there are people in our community, in our world, in community relations, in diversity and inclusion, and the athletes themselves that are making such change on such a grand scale and impacting on everyone on such a large level, that I think the sports world actually should take a lot of credit for that, or at least a pride in being part of a movement and a progress forward.
I think that's a great way to put it, is that it should, we should take pride in that, and not shy away from it, because, you know, there are a lot of folks who will work their entire lives and not have the opportunity to make the impact that we have in sports. And we should grab that by the horns and be intentional.
I find the subject of diversity, inclusion, and inclusion really fascinating as it applies to the sports world and just the world in general. The how behind it all, like, how does this happen? It's such a big conversation. But let's start with that part, that actual conversation. I hear this a lot, and I'm going to be blunt here. The common thing you hear from those of us that are not diverse, because I'm a 44-year-old white male, I'm as non-diverse as you get, is that it is important just to be having the conversation about these issues. I hear that all the time. It's just great we're having the conversation. But I kind of dislike that. I hate the idea that that's our goal, and that's such a low bar, that's all we really care about, is like, well, we're talking about it, and that's a good first step. And I want to push people in a way to aim higher and to stop patting ourselves in the back for just talking about it and allowing the conversation and actually going steps further, right? I mean, am I crazy for thinking that way?
No, not at all. I actually feel your pain in a way. And what I mean when I say that is, I think back to my start with minor league baseball. I think within 2 weeks, I sat down with mentors and thought to myself, this is going to require a lot of patience. And for anybody wanting to break into the field, diversity and inclusion, I think that would be my first bit of information or advice, is if you don't have patience, develop some. It's a lot of meeting people where they are. And so I think that's why the conversation of, it's good you're having the conversation at all, because, you know, it was a time where this wasn't even allowed to be spoken on. I think that's where that comes from, but I agree that we also have to graduate from that.
Right. Exactly.
We cannot stay there. So yes, great job. We're talking about it. Now let's put teeth on it. Let's put steps in order for us to get better in place, and let's hold ourselves accountable. I think as long as the conversation includes those elements, then I will say, great job, great talk. Otherwise, I'm right with you. We've got to do more. We have to set a higher standard in terms of how we engage. And I always compare it to, you know, think of business development. If we had a conversation around closing deals, we would not be happy that that's all we did is talked about it.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? And so we have to bring that same mentality to this, where it's okay to start, but we have to start with the end in mind and at least have some type of vision for what that end looks like. I will push back a little bit. You mentioned that you're as non-diverse as they come. I think that, and I'll say this, I understand what you're saying, but we have to contextualize diversity, because that could become something where that puts you out of the conversation, and we very much need you in the conversation. So you're not racially diverse, by what you mentioned, and there may not be that element of gender diversity depending on the crowd that it's in. But I think contextualizing it, diversity and inclusion has become such a hot button that it's almost lost its meaning. That's something I always like to do, is let's put some context on that, because I would consider you an extrovert based on that you have an entire podcast and what you do to serve young people breaking into sports. Introverts would look at that and consider it very different. So I think just taking every little characteristic that goes into making a you who you are and me who I am, if we're not the same person, there's an element of diversity. Now, we do want to be intentional, and that's where we might have to say we want to see more racial diversity, or we want to see more gender diversity within our organizations. I always say to be specific. Tell me what you want to
right.
see. Because diversity has just become too vague.
No, it's fair. I'll take that pushback. No problem. But I wanted to get it out there, too, that I'm a 44-year-old white male, and I want to make sure everybody knows that I'm speaking from that perspective. You know, that's where my feet are on the ground, and I don't want to pretend to be somebody that I'm not. So I just wanted to be clear about that as well. But I appreciate the pushback as well. Let's get into this minor league baseball conversation. Let's talk about your specific role, because you're the director of diversity and inclusion for a very large organization of teams. Big question here, how do you go about affecting change in minor league baseball? What does that process look like?
You know, the fun part about that is, we have 160 communities and it probably looks different in each one. But we go back to being director of diversity and inclusion for minor league baseball. This is also the first time this position ever existed. So
right.
there was no blueprint. There was no, hey, this is what the job looks like. It's we had a vision, and we still have our visionary leader, Pat O'Connor, but there is no blueprint to this day. And I think that's part of our culture as an industry, minor league baseball. We have a way of going about doing business that allows us to be more creative. It actually requires us to be more creative. We have to push harder. We have to get outside of our comfort zones. We have to get outside of the box. And I think that's been the approach to our diversity initiative, is how can we get outside of the box, get outside of what we've done, get outside of what we think we need to do, and go beyond that. So engaging teams is really the most important part of what I do, because that's the only way we're going to actually see change affected. We could paint a beautiful picture here in St. Pete with our office representation or what we do in our community, but if we don't get that same type of activity at 160 different communities, minor league baseball as an industry will not have a great story to tell. The beauty in that is our teams are chomping at the bit for what to do next.
Oh, that's good. That's really good.
Yeah. When we launched our Copa de la Diversión platform, we did a 14 pilot that graduated to a 33-team series in the 2018 season. Teams were clawing to get in.
Wow.
And it's the way that the foundation is settled, and I can't take credit. This was a huge collaborative effort, really the entire office of St. Pete, but led by our vice president, marketing strategy and research, Kurt Hunziker. The way that platform is positioned requires so much authenticity and genuine interaction in your community that you can't fake it. You can't get into this program and fake it. And I think that's the most important piece of what we do. Every step we've taken with our diversity initiative has been an authentic step. If that authentic step leads to us stubbing our toe and going back to the drawing board and coming up with a better plan, we're 100% okay with that. We'll do that happily, because we're going to come right back even with the same authenticity, more prepared based on the feedback we've received, and now we can move forward. So I think that's been our approach, is just how can we be authentic? How can our approach be genuine, whether it's education and culture, whether it's collecting data, whether it's creating multicultural marketing platforms, or whether it's going to recruit and find new talent for the industry. How can we genuinely approach those different pillars and approach those different projects and make it so it's an authentic interaction, which I think is going to do wonders for us 5-10 years down the road.
Yeah, so you've been with minor league baseball now for a little over 4 years. How would you look back and evaluate where you were versus where you are now? Have you been able to kind of see the change from all the efforts that you're putting into it?
Wow. I think so. We've seen our industry become a lot more comfortable with the dialogue. And this kind of goes back to where you said, well, you're comfortable with the conversation. pat ourselves on the back. Thinking of where we were, it was, everybody knows diversity and inclusion is important. We all get it. You know, it's kind of like you check that box, you're a good person, business as usual. But now it's like, we know it's important, and now here's what we want to do about it. Here's what we're going to provide you as a team, and here are the initiatives we're going to create as a league, and now here are the steps forward for us. And I think that as it became a part of the conversation for us, we saw a lot more organic activity taking place, teams hosting their own women in baseball seminars, or team going out and engaging the black community in their market without a toolkit provided. Teams talking amongst themselves of how they can collaborate or share best practices to engage different groups of fans. And I think our people are so creative and so unique in how they want to approach their market that if we can get them thinking about this more often, not that it'll take care of itself, but we'll see a lot. We'll get them moving a lot quicker. So I think that's actually a big part of it, is just bringing that conversation to the forefront and making it so people can sit with their own thoughts, and then that turns into action. I think that's been probably the biggest shift I've seen in 4 years. Is first it was, we're going to start to have this dialogue as an industry. Now it's very interesting to see them talking back and telling me what they're doing,
right,
just because we had the conversation outside of the programs we've built for them. That's probably the most exciting thing.
For sure. On a broader scale in sports, I almost look at it, it's almost cyclical in a way. Like in the 50s and 60s, Bill Russell for the Celtics was not afraid to talk about social justice and the problems that he saw on the global scale. But then I remember during the 80s when I was kind of growing up, and in the 90s, Jordan, Bird, Magic, they didn't really talk about this kind of stuff. A lot of the athletes and stars of the time didn't really get on that platform. And now, again, it's starting to come back again. Guys like LeBron are talking about these things, and there's a voice out there. How important, in your view, is it that the athletes use their platform and the power of their reach to discuss these topics like social justice and inclusion? And of course, you have to include Kaepernick and a lot of the other voices in the NFL. Like, a lot of people are using those voices. How important is that to you?
I think it's immensely important. I think it actually kind of breathes life into me on a daily when I know that it's almost like if we view it as a greater mission. And, you know, don't get me wrong, I love working in minor league baseball, but when I know LeBron James is committed to the same mission that I'm committed to, you know, you get a little pep in your step.
So I think there
are people in the diversity and inclusion space who I think we kind of draw encouragement when athletes use their platform to push for social change, because it's kind of a lending their hand to the same mission that we're fighting for. And obviously the platform and the stage that they have is likely going to be bigger than anything I'll have in the near future. So to be able to attach to some of their words is always very impactful. And it's encouraging to see. I think optically, when you think of kids playing sports now, to just understand that there's more to this than the game. You know, we talked about that a lot on this conversation, that even as executives, we have to understand there's more to this than what happens during the 3 hours that we're going to have sport activity taking place. So for athletes to understand that as well, I think is important for their own individual and socialized, but then also for their communities and just the greater society at large.
Vince, there are 256 minor league baseball teams. I think you're making a pretty big influence as well.
Our footprint gives us quite the opportunity to really make a change.
Yeah, for sure. So just a few years back, I want to use a little case study here. The Atlanta Hawks were like in the middle of controversy. Danny Ferry was their GM at the time. He was connected to scouting reports on Luol Deng that were inappropriate and insensitive. Then their owner self-reported himself on sending out a racist email. I mean, this franchise was not the model for tolerance. And then fast forward a few years, and the Hawks just recently received an NBA award for inclusion leadership. This is a long way of asking you about change and how it happens. How do organizations and leagues make those dramatic changes necessary to improve their operations like the Hawks did?
Yeah, I think, well, one, I've got to give a shout out to Ingersoll in Atlanta. I know it's an organizational effort, but she is a martyr in this space and a muse that I look to. You know, if I had a Mount Rushmore for D&I folks in sports, she would definitely be on that Mount Rushmore. But I think it's almost similar. It's almost based on like personality of an organization. And I bring it to like an individual level. You know, I might know as a person that there are things that I need to do better, that I need to improve. There are things that I do wrong. But for whatever reason, until I get in some trouble for it, I don't seem to make a change. But I think that's part of the personality is you kind of get exposed. And you're kind of now going to be held accountable at a new level. And so you commit. And I think it is genuine, that commitment, fortunately for the Hawks. And I think now they're getting to reap the fruit from that. And there are also organizations who organically or naturally just do things in an inclusive manner. So they don't need to, you know, and back to a personality, there's some folks who don't need to be told to work out 3 times a week. They just naturally have that built into them. So I think it's kind of organizational personality. It probably does start at the top, and to relay it back to minor league baseball, I'm fortunate that, you know, when Pat succeeded as president and CEO in 2008, this was one of the first initiatives he put in place, the diversity initiative. And granted, I was hired in 2015 to manage it. From 2008, everyone in this industry heard from him that diversity and inclusion is going to be important under my leadership.
Right.
That gives me a much easier job to do. And I think it just puts us in a position to avoid some of the downfall that may come with a misstep or that type of exposure that the Hawks had to go through in their earlier years, and then actually have a more organic approach to becoming an award-worthy industry. But I think that, you know, changes, it can happen in a lot of different ways. But for that specific case study, I think it was the, you know, it's the exposure and now you got to change. But kudos to the organization for doing so in a way that was real, because, you know, there's a lot of window dressing that happens in diversity inclusion space as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, that sometimes you need to get caught and see the repercussions of it before you start to make some real tangible changes. And again, I'm with you. Good for the Hawks for making that change happen. I know it's impossible to predict, but where do you think we are with diversity inclusion in sports looking down the road 5 to 10 years? Because it feels like if you looked back 5 to 10 years, I don't know if we would have predicted that we've made it this far. So we need to go even further. And I say we because I think it's all of us. What do you think we will be in 5 to 10 years?
That is a difficult one to predict. I think that we will be in a much better place. But I actually say, I look at the Silicon Valley model in terms of sharing data. You can go on any of their websites. I think that's one thing that I would like to see for myself and my peers in sports in 5 to 10 years. Let's be more transparent.
Yeah.
Let's not just tell the story, but let's use the numbers. And let's not make a third party organization have to do it. Let's do it ourselves. So hopefully I would like to see that, just kind of, you know, maybe catch up to the times with some of the other practices that are taking place in the D&I space. But I think that we'll see a lot more activity, a lot more intention around what's happening, probably a lot more sophistication and better storytelling. What I hope we don't see is kind of like the ebbs and flows that you mentioned, is that, you know, we're hot right now and in 10 years we see it kind of cool off just to come back in 20 years.
Right.
I hope we are to avoid that.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll finish up with this. And I'm really enjoying this conversation. I think you and I could probably go on for another hour or two, but I know you have things to do. So we'll finish up with this. is this a field you believe will continue to grow across all sports teams and leagues? Because it seems like it is right now, and I know we're in kind of a growth cycle. But do you think that will continue? And if so, how does somebody, a young person who's in college right now and thinks this is their calling, how do they get interested in the movement and get more involved and possibly see a D&I career for themselves?
No, I think that's a great question. And I do envision that this will grow in a lot of different ways. So you'll see the diversity and inclusion specific roles. You will also see multicultural marketing roles. You'll see talent acquisition and those types of positions that focus on finding diverse talent at colleges and universities or beyond. But I would say if someone has a really specific interest in diversity inclusion work, I would find a way to start doing that in something that allows you to use whatever your unique tool set is. So I would, if you really want to get into community relations, for example, I would find a way to impact diverse communities. If you want to do D&I and you've got a niche for marketing, find out ways to create multicultural marketing platforms. Or do your research and understand what organizations are doing well there and see how you can get involved. The only thing I alarm students on is pigeonholing yourself into pursuing just that diversity inclusion specific role. Understand that this work is important. If we need every person in the organization thinking this way. So don't think that you have to be the D&I leader to bring diversity and inclusion to your team. You can be the, like I said, community relations, communications, marketing. We need diverse minds and diverse mentalities in all of those departments. So I think creating the initiative, though, there will be more positions. You know, just 4 short years ago, my role didn't exist, and the associate that I just recently hired didn't exist. So those are two positions by themselves. But I think if it's your specific interest, think of how you may be able to create that same impact in a different type of role, because I think that's just as important.
I know I said earlier that I bristle at just having the conversation and acting as if that is a high enough bar and that we need to do more than that. But I have to say, I really enjoyed this conversation. So I
did as well.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming on the show, Vince. And I hope that we can do it again, because I think there's going to be a lot more to talk about in the future. And these conversations are important, that's for sure.
Yeah, they're important. And you know, they're fun, Brian. I really enjoyed this. I appreciate what you're doing and engaging young people. And I'm glad that we were able to meet and do this, and definitely look forward to doing more. If at any point it makes sense, let's do it again.
Thanks for coming on, Vince. I really appreciate it. I've said since the day I started this podcast that I wouldn't shy away from any issue, whether it's honesty about the real life of working in sports or the importance of social justice, diversity, and inclusion in our industry. I want to thank Vincent Pearson for having this honest discussion with me, and I hope you got as much out of this interview as I did. Thanks for listening, and hopefully altering your perspective or opening your point of view just a bit more.